Hello, this is Brian Cam, and you are listening to Clear Story, a podcast in which I discuss a piece of prose and a piece of poetry that I've been thinking about. This week I had two ideas about things I might read. One was related more to last week, the Althusser piece, and that was the basis of ideology in the French Enlightenment and in the French Revolution. I think I'm going to hold off on that one and instead discuss someone from just over a century later named Viktor Shklovsky. Shklovsky was a Russian formalist critic, a literary critic, who, in addition to writing his own fiction and poetry, also wrote criticism of those things. Shklovsky was born in 1893 and died 2 days before I was born, actually, in December of 1984. He fought in the First World War, during which time he was also writing philosophy and criticism. And he's now associated with a movement called Russian Formalism. That was a movement of literary criticism, which lasted from the 1910s to the 1930s. And I have not read any other Russian formalist critics, so I'm not going to talk too much about that movement, but I will talk about Shklovsky, who was probably the most prominent of those critics in any case. So I first learned of Shklovsky through a class I took at Princeton on Tolstoy. And that class was on War and Peace and Tolstoy's short fiction. It was taught by a professor named Carol Emerson, who is herself a major figure in the translation and scholarship around Tolstoy and Slavic languages and literatures more generally. She's one of those professors that made a big impact on my interests, on my way of viewing the world, and just on me generally. And so I am very grateful to her, not least because she also introduced me to Shklovsky. Now, I've recently tweeted a little bit about Shklovsky, and some people seem to like learning about him and his ideas. But before I talk about his ideas, I thought I would give a little bit of background into his life, which was really crazy. Now, I said he was fighting in the First World War. So in fall 1914, he joins the army as a volunteer. While he's there and fighting, he writes Art as Device, which is one of the most famous things he wrote and which I'm going to read to you from. He then participates in 1917 in the February Revolution as a member of the Socialist Revolutionary Party. In that spring, he receives the Cross of St. George for courage. He then leaves to North Iran to fight in the Caucasus campaign. And this is when it starts to get crazy. So he plots against the Bolsheviks and he works in the Socialist Revolutionary Party to plan a coup. He goes to Kiev to try to fight for Ukraine's independence, and his brother Nikolai, who's 28 years old, is executed for this. His brother Yevgeny, who's 30, is killed while trying to help the wounded in Ukraine, I believe. Somehow, Shklovsky himself survives and marries a woman named Vasilisa Korty, who's a nurse and a stage designer. That same year, his sister Yevgenia, who's 27, dies from malnutrition, leaving behind two daughters. In 1920, Shklovsky participates in a duel, and he ends up fighting in the Ukraine with the Red Army against the White Guard. He's then wounded while dismantling a grenade, and 18 splinters remain in his body for the rest of his life. That same year, he also returns to Petrograd and is elected as a professor for literary theory at the State Art History Institute. Now, there was an amnesty that came in for socialist revolutionary members in 1919, but in 1922, that's unofficially revoked. So they start rounding up people who have connections to this party. So spring of 1922, he crosses the frozen Gulf of Finland to get out of the Soviet Union. He goes to Berlin, where he falls in love with a woman named Elsa Triolet. But then in fall, he actually solicits the right to return to Soviet Russia, in part because his wife, Vasilisa, is imprisoned there. He writes a few books in the next few years, and in 1925 he starts working for the Third State Cinema Factory as a writer and a film editor. He makes some films, he writes some books, and by 1930 the Stalinist repressions start to intensify. So in 1930 he writes A Monument to a Scholarly Mistake, which is sometimes translated as A Monument to a Scientific Error, in which he retracts some aspects of his previous literary theory, probably under pressure from Stalin. Although I haven't yet read it, and so I'm going to be looking into that in the future. In 1932, Shklovsky travels to the White Sea, where Gulag prisoners, including his brother Vladimir, are building a canal. Shklovsky manages to sort of help him, but 5 years later, Vladimir is found and shot at age 48 in 1937. Nonetheless, Shklovsky is still alive. He is decorated with the Order of the Red Banner of Labor and gets that twice more in his life. And then in 1945, his only son, Nikita, is killed on the Eastern Front at age 21 in the Second World War. In 1949, notwithstanding all the awards and insane things that have happened to him so far, he becomes branded as anti-patriotic and anti-Soviet. So his work is boycotted for a very long time. But he nonetheless stays in Russia and keeps writing. He writes a biography of Tolstoy in 1963 and several more books before his death in 1984. When he dies in a Moscow hospital, aged 91. His life is actually even crazier than that, if you can believe it. The affair that he had in Berlin was this really torrid, insane, long-running thing where he was going back and forth, and he kept writing even while he was fighting, while he was sick in hospital, while he was dying. He was writing, writing, writing. And if any of this sounds interesting, I will post in the show notes a link to a very good article which is called Both a Fish and an Ichthyologist, because he was not only a writer of fiction, but a critic of fiction, which was common in the sort of 18th and 19th centuries, but becomes increasingly rare as time goes on. And so that is in the LA Review of Books, and it's a review of a book called Shklovsky, A Reader, which is edited and translated by Alexandra Berlina. It came out in 2016, and I highly recommend it. I'm still in the process of reading it now. And I'm going to read to you from his piece called Art is Device, which I've already mentioned. And that was written 1916-17 and then revised a bit in 1919. And it is by far, I would say, his most famous piece of writing. It's just a short essay. It's probably about a dozen pages or something like that, and you should be able to easily find it, but I'll provide a link in the show notes as well. And so one reason that Tolstoy has come up a few times already is that many of Shklovsky's examples in his literary criticism are drawn from Tolstoy, and this one is no exception. So he uses Tolstoy's diaries, but also specific works by Tolstoy, and I'll give some examples of my own rather than reading his. So the passage is about a term called ostranenie, and in English it's usually translated as defamiliarization, the process of making something unfamiliar or new again. And Shklovsky writes in Art as Device, 1917 or 1919. And so, what we call art exists in order to give back the sensation of life, in order to make us feel things, in order to make the stone stony. The goal of art is to create the sensation of seeing and not merely recognizing things. The device of art is the ostranenie of things and the complication of the form, which increases the duration and complexity of perception, as the process of perception is its own end in art and must be prolonged. Art is the means to live through the making of a thing. What has been made does not matter in art. So you can hear that he's talking about making things new again, making them unfamiliar when they've become overly familiar. And also that the point of art is to increase the duration and complexity of perception. So things you might look at every day and not notice, what he would call merely recognizing an object, is different from seeing it as it is, or in a way that's more like what it is, with conscious attention, let's say. Now, as I said, I think Shklovsky gives examples from Tolstoy's diary, but I can just off the top of my head think of examples that this happens in Tolstoy's fiction. So one would be in Haji Murat, one of his last novels, written about a Caucasian rebel commander who forges a kind of uneasy alliance with the Russian Empire, which he had been previously fighting. I think Tolstoy finished it in 1904, and it was published after his death sometime. But in it, he uses Haji Murat's status as an outsider to Russian society as a mechanism for defamiliarizing things, because he could describe familiar scenes, or scenes that would have been familiar to a late 19th century or very, very early 20th century Russian audience, in terms that are very unfamiliar, as if they're seen from the outside. In War and Peace, you can also think of examples. The ones that come to mind for me are the opera scene where Natasha's suspension of disbelief fails her, and she starts to see people as these strange actors wearing these weird costumes, and there's this bizarre set, and it all becomes present to her, breaking the illusion that you would normally have while watching an opera. So this is a way of defamiliarizing the opera and looking at it in a different way or with a different kind of attention. Maybe you might even think of something like metacognition, or you might think of Heidegger's distinction between something that is ready at hand, a tool that is ready to be used, and something that is present at hand, which is the object of some kind of examination, the sort of scientific way of looking at something. So in Being and Time, he's writing about das Zeug, which is stuff or equipment or paraphernalia or something like that, which is kind of hard to translate. But you could just think of this in terms of a hammer, let's say, which is as you're hammering, the hammer sort of becomes a part of your body in a quite real way, in that you start to sense things through the hammer and to extend your body or your sense of your body into it. And you can kind of tell where it's going to hit and things like that, in a similar way to if you were using your fist. Now, if the head of the hammer comes off and you're suddenly left with just a piece of wood, you are going to notice the hammer as a thing that's present before you, as an object worth examining, rather than just as an affordance or a sort of instrumental way of interacting with the world that you don't notice. You could say, at that moment, the hammer becomes defamiliarized. Now, why am I so interested in this? It's a good question, because I learned this concept probably almost 20 years ago, and I've thought about it a lot since then. I do agree with Shklovsky that much effective art allows you to look at the mundane and see it for the first time. And as I'm saying that, you might think of T.S. Eliot's Little Gidding. And maybe I will just read a little bit of that at the end of this podcast. I hadn't actually decided what poetry I was going to read, and that may be an appropriate one. But in future episodes, I'm going to refer to this concept of defamiliarization as a kind of critical part of learning, both at the individual level and at the level of society. You might also think of Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which I've mentioned before. There are these periods of crisis at which point science becomes very introspective. It starts to think about what it's doing. It starts to resort to philosophy, which it normally holds at arm's length. So I want to suggest that there's something really important, not just in art, but also in science and possibly in the life of an individual as well as the lives of nations or civilizations, that has to do with this divide between the familiar and the unfamiliar. You might think of it as safety and novelty, or as explore and exploit. Those are themes that I've been working on for the past year, and they go very, very far back indeed into philosophy, both Western and Eastern, and I'm gonna try and tie them all together, if not in this podcast, then in the future. So to recap, Shklovsky had a very turbulent, insane life. He wrote a piece about the goal of art being to defamiliarize people with their own world and to reawaken them to it. And I think that has much bigger implications for how the world is structured and how we relate to each other, how we form consensus, than might be obvious just from that quote. But I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to read to you from T.S. Eliot's Little Gidding. Little Gidding is the fourth of the four quartets, four quartets being a series of poems that Eliot published in 1942. If you're wondering why it's called Little Gidding, it's because it was partly inspired by a church built in 1714 in a place that's actually called Little Gidding, even though I've never been there. It's in Cambridgeshire. But after learning that fact, it kind of made me want to go to Little Gidding, so maybe I will actually end up going there and report back in this podcast, because the church does look very cool from the photos. So the entire poem is quite long, and I'm just going to read you the ending of it, fifth part. It's probably also the most famous part of the four quartets, as far as I know. So this is the fifth part of Little Gidding by T.S. Eliot, September 1942. What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from, and every phrase and sentence that is right, where every word is at home, taking its place to support the others, the word neither diffident nor ostentatious, an easy commerce of the old and the new, the common word exact without vulgarity, the formal word precise but not pedantic, the complete consort dancing together. Every phrase and every sentence is an end and a beginning. Every poem and epitaph and any action is a step to the block, to the fire, down the sea's throat, or to an illegible stone, and that is where we start. We die with the dying. See, they depart, and we go with them. We are born with the dead. See, they return and bring us with them. The moment of the rose and the moment of the yew tree are of equal duration. A people without history is not redeemed from time, for history is a pattern of timeless moments. So while the light fails on a winter's afternoon in a secluded chapel, history is now and England. With the calling of this love and the voice of this calling, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning, at the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree. Not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard in the stillness, between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here, now, always. A condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire and the rose are one. So, thank you for listening. I think you can hear that there's some relationship between this exploration stuff and seeing things anew, as Viktor Shklovsky does, or at least I hope you can, and it's not all completely in my head, which may also be the case. But anyway, thank you again. I'm Brian Kam, BryanKam, Kilo Alpha Mike, on Twitter, on Clubhouse, though on Clubhouse I have a dot, and elsewhere. You can find me at briankam.com. And I would love to hear from you. Maybe Twitter is the easiest place to reach me, so please feel free to DM me, or you can find my other contact information on my website.